Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Now, it's Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian on the Grizzlies and beyond. Every weekday around 10 a.m.
Before the morning came, we put a handle on the world and decided that we'd give it to this world. L.A. Blues, L.A. Blues, you want me to be like
Chris Harrington joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
It's L.A. Blues by the great and vastly underrated Tom T. Hall, about stepping off the plane into L.A., coming from Tennessee, really, probably, or maybe Kentucky, depending on where he lived at the time. Something the Memphis Grizzlies did yesterday.
Memphis Grizzlies play the Lakers tonight. They will be doing it without Desmond Bane because he is off. He lost his grandmother, and so he is will not be playing tonight. Chris has two columns up, one from yesterday that I missed somehow, and then one from today on the Grizzlies that I have just now tweeted out that I would like to talk about. The Grizzlies column is five different thoughts you have on the Grizzlies at this stage. One is Ja Morant, and two questions about Ja Morant. What have you noticed recently about Ja Morant? And particularly, you mentioned reuniting him with Jonas Valanciunas has been good for his game. But also, evidently, his defensive numbers are notably awful. What are we to think of that?
Well, I think you have to be careful with the idea of defensive numbers to start with. And so I'm going to come around to agreeing with the assertion, but or the opening statement. But, you know, when you the defensive numbers cited aren't really his defensive numbers, or the defensive numbers of the team and when he's on the floor, right? And that's an indicator of things, but it tends to be a noisy indicator. And so, you know, I think generally proceed with caution and apply that to individuals.
So the numbers suggest that when he's on the floor, the Grizzlies have been woeful even more.
Yeah, if you look at the team defensive rating in Ja Morant's minutes, it is by far the worst on the team, and there's a big gap. Like, if you look at the team defensive performance in every individual player's minutes, D'Anthony Melton is separated from everyone else in a good way, and Ja Morant is separated from everyone else in a bad way. And then, like, you know, and then you sort of start, you can start to work from there and try to figure out the whys, which I think is always important. And I'm not sure about the whys. Like, I do not think Ja Morant's a good defender. I don't think he's ever been a good defender. I think that was a known thing coming into the league, right? Like, a lot of offensive-minded smaller point guards, you know, are you going to make it, you know, what are you going to be defensively? And I think the hope has always been that Morant, with his athleticism, would be at least an average defender, right?
Right.
So I don't think he's ever been labeled a good defender. It's never been assumed that he'll be necessarily a plus defender, but can you at least be a hold your own, like you're not a minus? I don't think he's particularly good now. When I watch the games, I don't say, Ja Morant's defense, that's the problem. And so I'm reluctant to say, Ja Morant's defense, that's the problem, based on the numbers. You know, is there something there with the games he's played and he hasn't, given that he's missed a lot of the season? You know, he missed some of the games against, like, the really bad offenses, right, when he was out. So I think there's some noise in there. That said, there is a correlation between his minutes and the bad defensive play. And I don't think he's an individually good defender. But I would be careful to draw too firm a conclusion on that.
You do think that defensively, since this is the topic right now, that they're really missing De'Anthony Melton?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could see that really in those losses, specifically to the Pelicans and to the Raptors. I mean, Melton played in the Pelicans game. That's the game where he got hurt. And if you look at the two, you know, the lineups that we've talked about, where they lost their leads playing, you know, these smaller, sort of less athletic lineups that sort of got overwhelmed, like Melton, a healthy Melton is probably in both of those lineups, and I think he makes some level of difference. And so, you know, I think to me, based on numbers and based on observations, like they're in alignment for me, I think Melton's probably the best defensive player on the team. And I think those bench units right now, especially with Brandon Clark out too, are generally so lacking in athleticism, I think the absence of Melton like really, really is really noticeable.
It's interesting. You said, once again, he has the best net rating on the team. He did last year. He does now. Tell people what net rating is. Net rating.
Yeah, it's the same thing we're referencing with John Morant. That's just what, in terms of net rating, not defense, but overall, that is what is how much do you outscore or get outscored in the minutes of players on the floor. And it's expressed per 100 possessions just because that's right. Not a number that's digestible.
Right. Okay. Job beyond that, his play over the last few games and his reunion with Jonas. What have you noticed?
You know, Josh shooting numbers the last two games are not good if you just look at the stats. But I mean, I went and I looked at the shot chart and I just watched all the shots. And I do think he's gotten better shots the last two games than he had, you know, those earlier in the month. When I wrote that column on Monday, I actually put two shot charts side by side. And then the first one, where he played so well, you could see a hard cluster of shots right at the rim and a big band of shots in the floater range. And then the second chart I put up, where he'd been struggling, you could see this sort of spray of misses that was in between. And basically it was him trying to get to the rim, but the defense stopping him before he got there, rather than either getting floaters in front of the defense or getting past the defense to the rim, right? So that's what you're seeing in those charts. And if you look at his shots in the last two games, it looks a little bit more like the first one. I think he's getting the right shots. He's just been missing them. He's missed, in that Toronto game, he missed three or four floaters that are the exact same shots that he was just killing people with at the start of the season.
The road trip is the Lakers and the Kings, and it is a tough that is a tough road trip. The Lakers are really good and have the best defense in the league. And then the Kings have given them, and let's be honest, De'Aaron Fox has given Ja issues.
De'Aaron Fox outplayed Morant last season. Like the two guards who notably like really gave Morant problems last season were De'Aaron Fox and Drew Holiday, who was with the Pelicans at the time. And then De'Aaron Fox in the month of February is averaging 30 points and 9 assists. Like, you know, I mean, this whole like John Morant all-star discussion, which is really, like, it's not really a discussion.
It's not a real thing.
No, it's not at all. De'Aaron Fox, I think, is probably, like, I think neither of them are going to make the all-star team. But I think De'Aaron Fox, if anything, is, like, ahead of Morant in that pecking order at this precise moment.
Yesterday, who was it, Jeffrey, who released his projections?
Kurt Goldsberry.
Kirk Goldsberry over at ESPN released his projections on how the West would play out going forward. And Jeffrey has them. Jeffrey, could you tell us what the projections are?
Oh, you have them as well, but if you would like me to read them, I'm happy to do so.
All right, so here we are. This is, and I think, honestly, this is aligns with what you have said before, okay? But here we go. In the West, he says the top contenders this is the odds that they will have a top three seed. The Lakers, 98.6% chance of having a top three seed. The Jazz, a 94.8% chance of having a top three seed. And then a little gap, the Clippers having a 77.5% chance of having the top three seed. Do you agree? Those are clearly the, he puts them in one tier. Would you put those three in one tier?
Yes, I agree.
Okay, next one, Suns, this is chances to finish six or better. Suns, 78.7%, Nuggets, 76.4%, Warriors, a significant gap, 56.2%. 2%. So essentially that gets you to six teams with the Warriors at the bringing up the rear. Confident in that?
I'm Suns and Nuggets, yes. I'm not sure I would put the Warriors in the same tier with Suns and Nuggets. I might have the Warriors in the next tier down because I think they are so dependent on Steph Curry. And so I think just, you know, what are the odds that, you know, Steph Curry misses 2 weeks with an ankle sprain or whatever. Just, right. You know, something happens and he misses 12 games. I think that really changes things for them. So I would probably put – I think the Warriors could definitely finish sixth, but I would not put them in the same tier as the Nuggets and right. the Suns to me.
His group three is a play-in bubble, and you would put the you would put them in the play-in bubble. And
yeah, I'd put the Warriors – I think the Warriors, I think he is in the right slot. I just think he is the wrong tier for, right. for me.
And then he has one, two, three, four, five, six, seven teams – seven teams – in the play-in bubble, and those he ranks them as follows. Portland, 58% chance to make the play-in. New Orleans, 57% chance. Dallas, 56% chance. San Antonio, 47% chance. Sacramento, 44% chance. Grizzlies, 27% chance. And Rockets, 26% chance. That's a lot to digest, but your thoughts?
I guess I don't have a lot of quarrel with the order, but I don't see, in terms of that numerical gap on the odds, I don't see there being that much of a gap between the Spurs and the Kings relative to the Grizzlies and Rockets. Right. I think it's much
you
more
would
of a jumble
them all,
than
lump,
that.
Lump them all together. He has he has Spurs and Kings basically at 47% and 44% chance, and the Grizzlies with a meager 27% chance to make the play-in. And in fact, if you look at the ranking generally, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, he has the Grizzlies essentially, if you correlate this to rankings, 12th in the West.
But that's very possible. I mean, that's a little bit lower than I would have projected them before the season started, but that's very much in the range of the possibility.
Of course, so much of this, he's using computer numbers, and that it's hard to factor in Jaren and Justice in that. Like, go ahead.
That's right. We have an assumption that the Grizzlies team will get better over the course of the season based on players returning, but, what players for all teams will be returning or what may be absent, it's all so volatile.
Right.
And that's why a lot of that player availability unknowns is what's going to sort out that jumble over the course of the season.
Those numbers that he has plugged in do not assume Justice and Jaren returning. And so, whatever, we will see how it plays out. You did another column yesterday that I had missed when I had you on, and it has to do with this very thorny issue of school being in session. And you have expressed your reluctance to weigh in definitively because it's just so damn complicated, among other things. And secondly, you're not sure you should be the one weighing in on it. And people like to be reflexive one way or another. In a hot take culture, I admire your reticence over doing it. But you didn't ultimately reach some conclusions, some things you are comfortable saying. What are you comfortable asserting definitively about where we are on schools and COVID?
Well, I mean, I think not only as a city of Memphis, but as a country, as a society, whatever, we have not put enough emphasis on the importance of in-school learning for the youngest kids. I'm talking about kindergarten, first, second, third, like that, right? And I think, to me, there hasn't been enough prioritization towards that, towards those kids relative to older kids and towards school relative to other things in society. And I think if we or anywhere else goes a full calendar year and we're coming up on it, where you have kindergartners and first graders who have not even had the option of being in a classroom, I think that's a failure. You can argue about what kind of failure it is, and it's all kinds of different kinds, I think. But, to me, even in the context of the pandemic, that is a problem that should have been solved, and we didn't put enough priority on solving that problem.
You also said with respect to – there was a quote. It was a fabulous quote. I don't have it right in front of me. But that when it comes to schools, we have overplayed the danger of the virus and underplayed the importance of being in school? Was that essentially the gist of it?
Yeah, I mean, that's not exactly what it says, but that's sort of the gist. And that's something that it was quoted in Beverly Robertson right. at the Chamber. She quoted that in her letter. But the academic she quoted is someone I had referenced like earlier in the year, and someone who's been writing a lot about school issues. And yeah, and that gets to it's the idea that we put so much emphasis on, you know, more business oriented concerns than school concerns in terms of, you know, in terms of what's open and what's closed. But at the same time, we sort of, you know, based on the evidence we have, we overplayed a little bit, you know, the dangers of school in the context of putting good mitigation techniques in, right? There's a slippery slope danger here of saying, you just open the schools and throw everybody in and like it's not a problem. And that's not what the science says. It says that among younger kids, if you have good mitigation techniques, everyone's wearing masks, good ventilation, blah, 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 like there's not a lot of evidence that it's a big driver of spread. And to the other point, when we talk about like schools being closed in Shelby County, like to me, what's sort of left out of this is that schools are not closed in Shelby County. Like Shelby County schools, capital SCS, are closed physically, but like Shelby County schools, you know, capital S schools, like are all kinds of right. them are open all over the place. And to me, like dealing with that, like sort of that imbalance, to me is the big issue.
Well, it's hideous. It's hideous. The idea that, I mean, there's all kinds of jarring, you know, how can you, you can argue that the kids who need school to be open the most are the ones who don't, in person, are the ones who don't have it the most, you know.
That's right.
And you can also argue that with the restaurants and whatever open and schools aren't, like, there are so many jarring, almost immoral juxtapositions here that, that just make you just weep. But there is also, so as a society, one of our real issues is that we have not taken this seriously enough, right? Writ large, that we have not taken it seriously enough. We've not, the COVID generally, we have not planned enough. We've not whatever, all of that. But then also, there is also, I will say, on the part of some, a certain smugness about keeping school closed. Like there's almost a virtuousness of how reflexively, no, we can't have school. It's got to be closed. There can be from some quarters, it seems to be, with maybe.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and you ultimately do conclude that Memphis should have an established plan for reopening? What?
Yeah, I think we passed the point where indefinite, which is the current, you know, that's the current official, we're closed indefinitely. Like, indefinite is just not good enough anymore. And I'm not saying, like some people have, like, open all the schools tomorrow. To me, that's just not, I mean, it's easy to pound right. the table, but that's just not realistic. I think we've reached the point where there needs to be a plan that is presented that is actively moving towards giving an in-school option for the youngest kids. The idea that 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds will have a full year of not having the option, and everyone has to take this option. I mean, there should be no demand,
right?
But not having the option of in-person learning, I just don't. I think it's bad for all kids, like even at the high school level or whatever. But the idea that virtual learning is even remotely sufficient for 5, 6, 7-year-olds, it's just not.
Are you going to be cooking on Valentine's Day, Chris?
I have no idea. I can't plan ahead for anything.
I thought maybe you had a pork belly sitting around or something that you would be cooking up on Sunday. Well, all right.
I'm just trying to make it through the week, man.
Have a good weekend. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you on Monday. That is Chris Harrington.